Just keep in mind that there are three theistic faiths: Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. So we're defending theism. We'll talk a little bit about the exchange between the different theistic faiths a little later, but right now we're just trying to argue for theism. Again, we're looking at these different aspects of human experience. We already talked about the cosmological argument and the beginning of the universe, that the universe had a beginning and needs a cause, the continuing existence of the universe, the design of the universe, the possibility of human knowledge, eternal unchanging truths. Now we're talking about universal, eternal, unchanging moral laws, that they prove the existence of an eternal, unchanging moral lawgiver. Now we can go to a little bit more detail on this. You should have a page somewhere that says refuting moral relativism, somewhere in the packet. If you could look around for that. I'm not sure if it's after evil and human suffering or
after Pascal's wager.
Okay, it's in the Pascal's wager. And refuting moral relativism. A moral relativist, obviously, we talked about it already. It's someone who believes what is right for you is right for you. It doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. Each person decides what is right or wrong for themselves. And but it's kind of like God and morality. God and absolute morality go hand in hand. It's almost if God is an absolute morality, moral laws that apply to all people at all times and all places. No God, no absolute morality. You'll find many atheists, philosophers go through highly complex arguments. Some of their arguments sometimes take 300 or 400 pages, just trying to justify moral value judgments without the existence of God. Yet if God exists, moral absolutes are a given. God doesn't exist, there's really no basis for absolute morality. So what you try to arrive at is some kind of principle through which, if we all gather around this principle, it will help encourage the continuing existence of our species. Now that begs the question: is that, how do you know that's a good thing? If there's no such thing as good and evil, no such thing as right and wrong, why is it right and good to do things that would enhance the survivability of our species? Sometimes they call it the harm principle, that you shouldn't, you know, cause harm to others and all, but it's like, why? Why not? And, you know, the real answer is because that's wrong. You shouldn't, you know, it's wrong to do something like that, but then we're bringing absolutes in. But you could also, I mean, the relationship is so close that You could also say, if absolute morality, then God, no absolute morality, no God. Of course, we're talking about a personal God, a theistic God, that if you could prove absolute moral laws, okay, then you could prove God's existence. If you could prove that there are no absolute moral laws, then you would also be able to disprove God. It's a package deal. And it's the same way, I mean, it's not just theoretically a package deal, but it's also a package deal existentially, as far as, you know, people living. Many atheists first reject God. And then after they reject God, they say, okay, God doesn't exist. And they say, oh, no. Wait a minute. If God doesn't exist, then moral absolutes don't exist as well. I better argue against them as well, okay? Some of them are upset by that, okay? Others, they reject God's moral absolutes. You know, God says, thou shalt not do this in the Bible. And the guy grows up saying, hey, I want to do that. So, because they first reject the absolute moral law, then they reject the moral lawgiver as well. So, on this sheet for refuting moral relativism is the idea that each individual decides for themselves what is right and what is wrong. Each individual decides for himself or herself what is right and what is wrong. Whereas those who hold to moral absolutes believe that there are some moral laws, not all moral laws, we don't, you know, we're not all upset because there's no temple in Jerusalem because we need to go down and offer an animal sacrifice, but there are some moral laws that apply to all people at all times in all places. That's what we mean by a moral absolute or a universal moral law. For me, it's really, if your worldview, and this is any worldview that is not theistic, any non-theistic worldview cannot support absolute moral laws. And in my way of thinking, if your worldview cannot call rape and incest universally wrong for all people at all times in all places, it's time to get a new worldview. So right there, I think theism stands head and shoulders above all the other world views. But then when it comes to, okay, so now there's this all-powerful, all-good God that exists, and we're obviously messed up, how do we get saved? Then I think the Christian message of salvation by grace through faith in Jesus, who is God's substitute sacrifice, I think that shows the superiority of Christianity to Islam and Judaism. Because in the end, you've got God somehow sweeping sin under the rug or whatever. But I think in the area of morality alone, theism can be shown to be the superior worldview. Now, an argument for the absolute moral law, again, if you argue for the absolute moral law, all you got to do is add one premise at the end of it, and you're arguing for God. Again, it's a package deal, you know? It's not either or, it's both end. You get the personal moral God of the Bible, you get his absolute moral laws. You take him away, the moral laws go with them. And even many atheists like Friedrich Nietzsche have gone on record saying that. But for point A, the argument for the absolute moral law, the moral law doesn't ultimately originate with the individual. The moral law doesn't ultimately originate with the individual, and the reason for this is for them we could not condemn the actions of another person. You know, I could just throw out a few names: Hitler, Stalin, Osama bin Laden. Okay, for the person who tells you What's right for me is right for me, doesn't have to be right for you, and vice versa. We need to remind that person that if that is true, then we cannot call the actions of Hitler wrong. We can't call the actions of Stalin wrong. All the millions of innocent people that they slaughtered, and we wouldn't be able to condemn their actions. So usually you can press a moral relativist to the point where they acknowledge, okay, we need something more ultimate. Okay? So let's say we start with the individual, Rob, okay? And we're saying that, okay, obviously the moral law couldn't come just from him, because then we couldn't condemn another individual like Hitler wrong. So we've got to go to the next step up. So we go now to the Rob and Derek table. Okay? These guys have to learn how to get along and that type of thing. Supposing Derek, you know, brought in with him tonight this gigantic notebook that, you know, filled up the whole table. And he walked up to Rob and said, is it right if I sit down at your table? And Rob said, yeah, that'd be great. And then he breaks out this gigantic notebook and fills up the whole table. And now Rob's got no room to write. So they got to talk things over and work things out. So we see what's happening is now we have a little society there. And the individual views on morality are now giving way to a higher authority, kind of the society as a whole. And so some would argue that the moral law is the creation of each society. They say, okay, individuals aren't the ultimate cause, but the society is. America has its own set of laws. Egypt has its own set of laws, you know, things of that sort. But the problem with this, moral law is not the creation of each society. What do you think the problem would be there? Okay, you have a society. You have a one-person society, a one-person society. You have a two-person society over there, different tables. What's the problem with society being the ultimate arbiter when it comes to moral laws? What's that? Well, that would be fine then with your society. We just come up with its own laws for you guys.
What if they travel
to Earth? All right, yeah. What if you guys then decide to say, hey, you know, this is a boring lecture. We're not having a good time. Hey, I got some, you know, Rob says, I got some really, really sharp pens. Let's start throwing them across the room at these other tables, at these other societies, okay? So basically what it amounts to is, if the moral law ultimately can be traced to societies as represented here tonight by tables, okay, then one society or one table cannot condemn the actions of another table. Okay? So the moral law is not the creation of each society, for then one society could not condemn the actions of another society. And we wouldn't be able to condemn the actions of Nazi Germany, Bin Laden's Taliban, Al-Qaeda, you know, the list goes on and on. The Allies wouldn't be able to say, well, yeah, Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, they're wrong, and we condemn their actions as wrong.
Well, then that almost goes all the way back to the point where you're making it like last week or before about the world. God doesn't have to go to one of them.
That's the next stage. The next stage, point C, would be, okay, well, maybe it's not each individual society that decides. Maybe it's a world consensus. And for tonight's purposes, this room is the world. Okay? And so we just vote on everything, and it's, you know, pretty obvious. We don't really vote on anything, so do we ever really know? I suppose there's been some times in the past we've been pretty confident on what the world consensus was, but we can't be confident on everything. But whatever the case, point C, the moral law doesn't come from a world consensus, because we know that the world consensus in the past has not been infallible. it was at one time the world consensus was that the world was flat, that this was a geocentric universe, that everything including the sun revolved around the earth rather than the earth around the sun. Slavery was perfectly permissible, was considered just part of life. There was no such thing as woman's rights. The woman was pretty much just property of the man. So if the world consensus has been wrong in the past, what makes us think, well, why should we give it infallibility now? But there's a more important point here, and that is that even atheists try to change the world for the better. So, we've gone from, okay, they might say, okay, each individual decides. Okay, well, then you can't condemn Hitler. Okay, maybe each society decides. Okay, well, then you can't condemn the Nazi Germany. Okay, well, then maybe it's a world consensus. But you see atheists leading these marches trying to make the world a better place to live because they disagree with the world consensus, and they disagree with the world consensus because they believe the world consensus is wrong. So what that implies is that they believe that there is a moral law or a moral standard above all individuals, any society, any world consensus, a moral law that is above all of that. Now they're not going to admit that, but they sure act that way. You know, there's no such thing as right and wrong, so I'm going to fight with every ounce of energy that I have to see to it that there is no prayer in the public schools and that under God is taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance or whatever. And it's like, wait, if there's no such thing as right and wrong, why fight for anything? If there's no such thing as right and wrong, why is it wrong to have under God in the Pledge of Allegiance and, not wrong if we removed it? I mean, it just doesn't make it. If there's no such thing as right and wrong, why protest anything? Why stand up for human rights? Human rights imply that humans deserve to be treated a certain way and that it's wrong to treat them in a certain way. And so even atheists try to change the world for the better. Point D is that there's a moral law qualitatively above all men. Number one, we're going to see that the moral law is not descriptive, it is prescriptive. Okay? We're going to see later on when we deal with deism that the laws of nature are descriptive, not prescriptive. Now, the laws of nature are descriptive. They describe the way things generally occur. Moral laws, though, are prescriptive. They prescribe the way things ought to be. Okay? Prescriptive laws demand a prescriber. Okay? So, number one, the moral law, which is qualitatively above all mankind, is not descriptive of the way things are. It is prescriptive, number two, it is prescriptive of the way things ought to be. So they bring in the whole idea of ought. Yeah. A.J. Ayers has tried to escape this. One of the 20th century's leading atheists, he tried to argue that to say murder is wrong, all we're saying is, I don't like murder. We're expressing our emotions, our feelings about something. But if that were true, you really can't condemn murder then. So, moral, but he was trying to escape the whole idea. Bertrand Russell did as well, tried to escape the whole idea that there was an ought contained in, you know, so many times. And another word is should. You know, you should do this, you should not do that. Okay? Time and time again, I've argued with moral relativists, and they always say that, look, I'm pro-abortion because there's no such thing as right and wrong. Therefore, you should not try to get, you know, each woman should decide for themselves whether they want to have an abortion or not. It's none of your business. You should not force your views on them, stuff like that. So they start out by saying there's no such thing as right and wrong, but in the end they tell you what you should and should not do. And so they say there really is no morality. Morality is an illusion, but then they use moral language. And point number three there, because of their prescriptive, you know, you ever try to get a prescription drug without a prescriber, without a doctor's signature, it's not going to happen. They won't give it to you. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. See, a prescriptive law is a command. Commands come from commanders. Okay? So we need a moral lawgiver, point number three, qualitatively above all mankind. By all mankind, what I'm talking about here is all individuals, all societies, and any world consensus. And point number four, if we've wished to condemn the actions of the past, you'll have atheists who will do that, condemn the actions of the past, and say, yes, slavery in the past was wrong, the way women were treated in the past was wrong. But if we wish to condemn the actions of the past, okay, we're actually appealing to a moral standard, a moral law that doesn't change with time. We're saying the same moral law. Slavery is wrong now, but it was also wrong in the past. Okay? So, if we wish to condemn the actions of the past, this moral lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging. In other words, you're acknowledging that the moral law doesn't change with time. It's eternal and unchanging. Therefore, the moral lawgiver cannot change with time either. It's also eternal and unchanging. Now, if you turn back to the evidence for God's existence, anybody have any questions on the moral argument or any comments? Okay, number seven, the meaning of life, purpose. Basically, just if God does not exist, life is absurd. If God does not exist, life is absurd. I don't care how much meaning an atheist can give to life. If the atheist acknowledges, and almost every one of them does, that there's no life after death, okay? I don't care how much temporary meaning you can pack into 70, 80 years of life. If when you die, you cease to exist, and if someday when the universe dies, the earth is going to cease to, everything man's ever accomplished will cease to exist as well. It just seems to me that there really is no ultimate meaning in life. And so, without God and life after death, life is absurd. The book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, is probably the first guy to argue in that direction. Let me just run through the rest of these, and then we'll spend a little bit of time on Pascal's wager. Number eight, reason to be optimistic about the future. Basically, a reason to have hope. that basically we're saying 7, 8, 9, 11 are almost all identical, just different ways of saying the same thing. But basically for number 8, God and eternal life are needed for eternal hope. I mean, you know, why wake up singing, you know, it's a beautiful morning, and just thinking, wow, this is great, life is great, I'm going to go out there, have a good time today, and things are really looking up, I'm pumped up, and all, you know, you're living a lie. If you believe that after you die you cease to exist, you shouldn't wake up in a good mood in the morning. In fact, I even question why you even get out of bed. Some guys are going to accomplish a real lot in 70, 80 years of life, and some guys aren't. But, you know, why strive? Why work hard and get out there and fight for what you think is right? And all, if there's no God and no life after death, there's no reason to be optimistic about the future. You know, like Paul said, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Number 9, the guarantee that evil will be defeated. The atheist brings up evil as a hypothetical, you know, what if type problem. Like, you know, if your Christianity is true, then how do you explain these things that would be evil? Well, the fact of the matter is, those things really are evil. Okay? When a baby is dying, okay, something is wrong here. Doesn't mean the baby sinned or the parents sinned to cause it, but it means if Adam and Eve didn't fall in the garden, innocent babies wouldn't die. And so atheists can recognize examples of evil so quickly that I think it begs the question, you know, do they recognize cases of evil so quick because they've studied Christianity and say, oh yeah, there's something that a Christian would consider evil. Of course I don't. No, they act like those things really are evil, and they try to use it as an argument against Christianity. When in actuality, if there is no God, if there's no ultimately good being, no real eternal goodness that exists, then there's no reason to believe that there's any such thing called evil. Okay? Evil is a perversion or a corruption of the good that should be there. So number 1, atheists can't explain evil. And then number 2, evil is real. What solution? I think a worldview, since evil is so obviously real, the fact that evil exists should not be a reason to throw a worldview out the window. I think ultimately the issue is, how well does your worldview respond to the problem of evil? What kind of solution is it? Is it a plausible solution that is offered? And I think the only real guarantee that evil will be defeated is the death, resurrection, and return of Jesus. That apart from the death, resurrection, and return of Jesus, there is no guarantee that evil will be defeated. Now, on this particular point, I'm arguing not just for theism, but for Christian theism. Feelings of guilt. I'll be honest with you, I feel like the feelings of guilt is probably the weakest argument on this page, but there's actually some atheists that deep down inside, it might be one of the most powerful arguments. You know, Sigmund Freud denied that God existed and then wrote books trying to explain away the feelings of guilt that all human beings experience. And so deep down inside, we all know we have sinned against the Holy God. I mean, you can... I think that most people would agree that people are more important than things. And so what if a person decides to sin in secret, and there's no other persons around, and they do a quote-unquote bad thing, and nobody's around, why do they feel guilty? If things are more important, if people are more important than things, why does a person still feel guilty if they do a bad thing in private, in secret? And what that tells me is that you can go into your private little world. If you do a bad thing, you have sinned against a person, an all-seeing person. Basically, even when people do something that is wrong and there isn't another human being that is the victim, they are still wronging a person, the infinite person. But I do think that there's more to this, more to guilt than meets the eye, and I think that's why Sigmund Freud spent so much time trying to explain away guilt. He believed there was no God. Well, if there's no God, how do you explain guilt? Fear of death, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but basically just animals fear the pain of dying, but humans fear what comes after death. You know, an animal is just—he's just concerned about pain, okay. But it's humans. You know, we could be dying and we could be drugged up so we don't feel any pain, and we're still terrified. Because you know, basically the scriptures teach God put eternity in our hearts, so we know that. You know, we think in terms of eternity. So we think about life after death, and are we going to be punished? Are we going to be rewarded? And that's why, you know, when a person's on their deathbed, okay, you don't hear a person saying, you know, hey, you know, guy telling his wife, go get my favorite atheist philosopher. No, they ask for either a preacher or a priest. Okay, so, you know, when people are on their deathbed, they know, okay, it's too late for the doctor, and I got to deal with issues of life after death. Respect for human life or human rights, in a universe, basically all we need to say there, in a universe without God, there are no human rights. In a universe without God, there are no human rights. Yet probably 99% of it, you know, at least 9 in every 10 atheists I ever met fight for human rights. I don't always agree with their views on human rights, but just the fact that they stand up and fight for human rights, and it's like, wait a minute, if there's no God, and we weren't created in God's image, and God didn't create us to go on existing eternally, you know, why do humans have dignity? Why is human life sacred? And it's as much as the atheist and the pantheist, for that matter, want to fight the idea that if there is no personal God, there are no human rights. As much as they hate that, you know, just look at how once we started throwing God out of the public sector in America, how human rights began to plummet. And all of a sudden now we're slaughtering unborn babies. And now there's people, and now we're slaughtering babies that are half-born, you know, they're... You could pull the legs out of the mother, and the doctor can insert an instrument to destroy the life of the baby and puncture the skull of the baby and kill the baby. We're talking about killing babies already born. Watson and Crick received the Nobel Prize for cracking the genetic code in the 1970s. They don't believe that God exists, so in their acceptance speech, they stated that we're playing God, and they thought that was great. They said, why not just say that a baby is not a human being until it's 3 days old? And that way, after a baby's born, doctors would have, and the parents would have 3 days to decide whether or not it fit in our definition of what a master race human being should be, and if not, we just get rid of it. And Peter Singer at Princeton thinks along those lines. He says now that the life of an infant human being is not worth as much, does not hold as much value as the life of a full-grown chimpanzee or pig. Okay, I mean, this is one of the world's leading ethicists, one of the world's leading experts, supposedly, on what's right and what is wrong, teaching at an Ivy League school, Princeton. He also believes if you're handicapped, your life is not worth as much as healthy people, and that the only worth that a handicapped person's life has is if a healthy person decides to, values their life. So in other words, his mother has Alzheimer's. Her life is worthy only because he, a healthy guy, cares enough to care for her. But if Peter Singer didn't care about his mom, then he would say that he should have the right to have her put to death, save him a lot of money and a lot of heartache. So we have I argued that, well, C.S. Lewis argued it, and so did Francis Schaeffer, that if God is dead, man is dead too. So you take God out of the equation, there's no value to human life. We got here by accident. We're nothing but mere molecules in motion, just like a mound of dirt is. So, if somebody kicks a mound of dirt, we're not going to hold a person morally responsible. Why should we hold them morally responsible if they kick a human being? So the whole idea of human rights presupposes the existence of a personal God. Free will and human responsibility. If only matter exists, then there is no such thing as free will, and we are not responsible for our actions. If only matter exists, then there is no such thing as free will, and we are not responsible for our actions. Basically, if only matter exists, then your choice to show up tonight, okay, your choice to show up tonight was not a responsible choice. All it was a chemical reaction that occurred in your brain, some kind of biological reaction, okay? And that made you come tonight. So, how could Cascade hold you responsible for missing class if your choice to miss class wasn't really a choice? It was just something that happened in your brain and you had to react to it. If you catch a cold, nobody's going to hold you responsible for catching a cold or getting cancer if it wasn't something caused by a choice like, chain smoking or whatever. Nobody's going to hold you responsible for that because it's a biological thing. It's something that was out of your control. But if there is no immaterial soul, immaterial mind, where we make our decisions and make our choices, then we're not free, and we can't be held responsible for our actions. And the fact of the matter is, even atheists want to hold people responsible for their actions. If a guy's a serial murderer, we don't want to see the guy walking around freely walking among other human beings. So, but the problem is, once you admit that there's an immaterial soul, that seems to me to be excess baggage to the atheistic worldview. Once you acknowledge there is an immaterial soul, then I think it begs the question, and leads to theism. Okay, Pascal's wager. Somebody can let me see. There's. I didn't make a copy for myself. So. I'll just. Let me see yours. I'm just going to try to sum up Pascal's wager. Okay, there's two possibilities. One is that God exists, and the other, that God doesn't exist, okay? And again, now Blaise Pascal, he did not gamble, okay? He was a Christian guy, very sickly. Even before he became a Christian, he didn't go out, he didn't party. But he's the guy that figured out and wrote the laws of probability. So he's probably in the history of mankind the foremost expert on what a good bet is and what a bad bet is. Okay, and so Pascal says, well, look, we can either wager. Against God, or we can wager for God. So we can either wager our lives, live our lives as if God doesn't exist, or we can live our lives as if God does exist. Okay? And, this isn't so much an argument. As it is, Pascal really believed the scriptures when it said in Jeremiah, I believe, 29:13, when you seek for God with all your heart, you will find him. Okay? So basically, wagering for God means to seek God, to live your life as if God does exist and to search for him. Okay? And to wager against God is to... just assume that he doesn't exist, okay? Pascal did not have a low... Many people believe that Blaise Pascal had a low view of reason. He didn't. He had a very high view of reason, but he wasn't an extreme rationalist like Descartes. Descartes believed you could prove everything through reason alone. So, responding to Descartes, René Descartes, Blaise Pascal said that, no... Reason is good, you know. We can find truth through reason, but it's limited. You know, we're not infinite in knowledge like God is. So our reason is finite, but it's also fallen. We fell in the garden, so sometimes we add, you know, 5 + 5, and we come up with 11. We get it wrong sometimes. So he said, reason is okay, but we've got to be tentative about it. It's not infallible. But Pascal believed there was a bigger problem than that. And the bigger problem was that we humans are not very rational. He agreed with Descartes that humans are rational beings, He disagreed with Descartes. We are not rational beings, period. Okay? In other words, we're rational beings, but there's more to us than reason. And he summed it all up under the word the heart. Our intuition, some things that we just know, but we don't know how we know. Our emotions, our will, okay? Things that we learn from God, he reveals to us in the Bible. So there's other ways of knowing things. Pascal argued that when we make our decisions, reason is usually the last thing, the last human faculty that we consult. So